This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.
Anti-Semitism, fundamental battles for human rights, control of the military and a civil society. These are some of the themes touched on by Robert Wistrich when he spoke at the University at Albany. Wistrich, professor of modern and Jewish history at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, talked about one of the enduring controversies of modern French history, the Dreyfus Affair. We begin with the introduction of Professor Wistrich.
He is the author and editor of 20 scholarly books. His books include Socialism and the Jews, The Dilemmas of Assimilation in Germany and Austria-Hungary, The Jews of Vienna in the Age of Franz Joseph, Anti-Semitism, The Longest Hatred. Professor Wistrich is now completing a new book, A Chosen Affair, Dreyfus, the French and the Jews. His topic this evening will be The Dreyfus Affair, A Century Later.
You might well ask, what is the point of this title? Why have I called it The Dreyfus Affair a Century Later? It began in 1894, but it concluded only in 1906. I hope that I can assume that most of you here are familiar with the bare bones of the story. It began, of course, when a French army officer of Jewish birth, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, was arrested and charged with selling military secrets to the Germans. He was tried in camera and found guilty of high treason. Unknown to him and to his defense counsel, secret documents, which actually included forgeries, although that was not known at the time, had been illegally passed by order of the war minister to the military judges, and this decisively influenced his conviction. He was sentenced to life imprisonment and sent to the appropriately named Devil's Island on the coast of French Guiana. Dreyfus suffered excruciating torture, solitary confinement for 4.5 years before he was brought back to France in the middle of 1899. That was in the wake of new evidence that was discovered and the campaign of a brave but small group of Dreyfusards, people committed to the revision of his case. In Rennes, in Brittany, in September 1899, he was tried again, a second court-martial, found guilty, despite the new evidence, but this time with extenuating circumstances, whatever that might mean. High treason with extenuating circumstances is certainly a bizarre appellation. He was almost immediately offered a presidential pardon, which he reluctantly accepted, although he continued to make great efforts to clear his name. But he had to wait until the 12th of July, 1906, before the Court of Appeals finally quashed the original verdict. Dreyfus was rehabilitated, he was reintegrated into the French army, and given the Légion d'honneur. By then, according to the French poet and Dreyfusard Charles Péguy, Dreyfus had become the most famous name in French history since the death of Napoleon. This affair was the last great crisis of the liberal 19th century. The affair was also, I would argue, the first great international media event. And this was due to the implosion, the enormous impact at the end of the 19th century of mass communications, of a mass circulation press, and the fact that the news and the commentary on this affair reached the four corners of the globe. Another factor in explaining its resonance would be the role played by intellectuals, artists, and writers, both for and against Dreyfus. This involvement of the intellectuals and of the press provided an ideological, a moral, and a universal dimension which lifted the Dreyfus case already in its own day above the mundane level of yet another spy story or a whodunit of labyrinthine complexity. Beyond that, there were two political traditions in France which confronted each other in this affair, the origins of which stretch back to 1789 and the legacy of the great French Revolution. By and large, those who fought for the rehabilitation of Captain Dreyfus belonged to a republican tradition of the rights of man. They stood for the inalienable rights of the individual, the universality of reason, truth, and justice. They were supported, after much hesitation, by the mainstream of the democratic socialist left in France, who feared a coup d'etat against the Republic, instigated by the army chiefs with the support of the nationalist right, the monarchists, the Bonapartists, and the more intransigent Catholics. For the more idealistic Dreyfusards, what was at stake was the integrity of France as a nation, which still believed in its own self-proclaimed ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity, that famous tricolore. The ringing tones of Émile Zola's J'accuse of the 13th of January 1898, which denounced the machinations, the lies, the forgeries of the French General Staff used to convict an innocent man, expressed this undimmed passion for the rights of the individual. This too was a crucial issue for the leader of the French socialist movement, a rising movement in the 1890s, Jean Jaurès. He insisted, against much opposition in the labor movement, that the prisoner on Devil's Island was indeed a matter of concern to the proletariat. Despite the fact that his own comrades asked the seemingly logical question, what is there in common between the interests of the working class in France and a rich, bourgeois, Jewish officer, member of the general staff? This is an internal bourgeois quarrel. No, said Jaurès, the prisoner on Devil's Island is no longer an officer, a bourgeois, or a wealthy Jew. In his exile and humiliation and the scandal surrounding his conviction, he has become a living witness to the military lie, to political cowardice, and to the crimes of authority. The victim of an inhuman social order. In his exile, said Jaurès, he is stripped of all class character. He is nothing less than mankind in the deepest abyss of despair. So the Dreyfus case, he insisted, was not a deviation from the class struggle, as other socialists argued, something of no interest to the French workers. Dreyfus was transformed into a martyr, a symbol of oppressed, despoiled humanity. Beyond that, the affair demonstrated how vital it was, even for the working classes, to preserve individual rights, liberty, the rule of law, and justice against those who would undermine bourgeois democracy. That too was the message of Georges Clemenceau, the editor of L'Aurore, the newspaper that had published Zola's ringing J'accuse, which first launched the affair with this denunciation of the general staff. And I want to say a few words about this man, Georges Clemenceau. I think probably, along with General de Gaulle, the greatest French politician of the 20th century, although he was born in 1840, and it was a man who played a decisively important role in many of the crises of the Third Republic, who became Prime Minister of France in 1906. And in 1917, he would literally save his country during the First World War. A quintessential French patriot. And yet, despite the fact that he was so identified with the French army in the First World War, when we go back to the Dreyfus Affair, we see him arguing passionately that the military must be subordinated to civil authority, and that the idea of justice, the power of an idea, is greater than any system of oppression, any dogma of infallibility, any arbitrary exercise of authority. Clemenceau, in 1897-98, was at that time out of politics, temporarily. He was, in fact, a journalist. But he sensed that the machinations behind the Dreyfus case, which had happened in the land of the French Revolution, were in fact a negation of all its central ideas. This was a case which exposed the sickness of French society, the weaknesses of the Republic, the dangers of a clerical military reaction. At the same time, it represented, in the form of the Dreyfusard opposition to this miscarriage of justice, a revolution of thought of immense force. As he saw it, the Dreyfus Affair was about the struggle of the revolutionary tradition in France against the blind authoritarianism of a caste. It was a battle for the Republic and for the idea, the inalienable idea of human rights, one familiar enough to Americans, for each citizen. It was also about the limits of military authority. What was the purpose of the army? To defend the principles of civilian authority, not to encroach upon or threaten it. The army of the whole nation must be permeated by universal ideas of justice. It must never rise above the law, as the French General Staff was doing. The principle of the military was obedience, order, discipline. The principle of civil society was right, liberty, and justice. But soldiers must ultimately be subordinate to the rule of law. This was the core of Republican patriotism. Military might was necessary for self-defense in a democratic society, but it could never be a goal in its own right. Clemenceau was outraged by the fact that in the original Dreyfus trial, which had been conducted in a closed court hearing, documents which convicted Dreyfus were never submitted to him or his lawyer. Did a Jew not have the same rights as any other citizen, he asked? And if not, then it would be the turn of Protestants. Remember, France is a Catholic country. And freethinkers who would come next. And what of the mob behavior which sought to intimidate judges and witnesses? Was this not a denial of tolerance and justice? And what of the verdict rendered, the sacrosanct verdict, what the French called la chose jugée, which you could not change? In the Zola trial, Clemenceau, who was one of the counsels for the defense, pointed to the crucifix which hung in the courtroom and declared, "You see this Christ on the cross? There it is, the verdict rendered." They should have placed that crucifix at the other end of the room so that the judges would have seen it before their eyes as an example of the judicial error which our civilization regards as a shame of humanity. Like many Dreyfusards, Clemenceau was in fact a militant anti-clerical. Indeed, He condemned the alliance of the sword and the holy water sprinkler, le sabre et le goupillon, as being a danger to the integrity of the Republic. And sometimes, like other Dreyfusards, he exaggerated the threat from the Catholic Church and the Jesuits, whom he firmly believed were seeking to undermine democracy in France. He thought that the affair was a deliberate attempt by the Catholic Church to overthrow the Republic. Therefore, the army and the educational system had to be liberated from clerical influence. And later, this was to be one of the most important consequences of the Dreyfus affair in France. In 1905, it led to the separation of church and state and the removal of clerical influence on French education. Above all, he thought that political Catholicism, which, like many radicals, he equated with dogma and sectarian intolerance, had to be uprooted if justice was to remain a central pillar of the Republic. "We have justice on our walls," he said, "in our dogmas, in our institutions, in our laws, in our books, in our poems, in our songs, in our plays. It is only absent in our hearts." Clemenceau realized early on that this battle for justice would have to be fought against the political parties, even against his own party, the Radicals, who were largely anti-Dreyfusard, even in the middle of 1898. The left, as I've already suggested, was divided and hesitant. The right and the Catholics were against any revision of the case. There was only one politician in France in 1898 of influence who was an open Dreyfusard, the veteran senator from Alsace and vice president of the Senate, Schorer Kestner. So the drama of the Dreyfus affair took place outside of the parliament, outside of the legislative body. It was played out in the streets, in the press. And who filled the role of the political class which failed in its democratic duty? The intellectuals, the poets, the writers, the artists, the scientists, who were the first to rally to the cause of Alfred Dreyfus. As Clemenceau noted in the newspaper L'Aurore, it is rare that in a movement of public opinion, it is the men of pure intellect who show up in the first row. But this was to be one of the most important consequences of the Dreyfus case in France. It was Clemenceau, a politician, who coined the word les intellectuels, the intellectuals, and he was the first to give it, their protest, a positive political meaning. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that the 13th of January, 1898, was the birth date of the modern intellectual, and it was Clemenceau who provided a name, just as he gave the name to Zola's open letter to the President of France, the original title of the article that rocked France, and he called it Jacques. His own influence came at that time through a prodigiously prolific journalism. The impetuosity, the irreverence, the sharp observations, the intransigence, and civic courage. Yet he was to be bitterly disappointed by the results after 1900. He felt that the affair had not been brought to its proper and complete conclusion. That General Mercier, the architect at that time Minister of War during the first trial, who had been amnestied and not brought to trial, and the perjurers and the forgerers on the general staff were not brought to trial, that this was unacceptable, and that Dreyfus himself, who had been pardoned by the President of the Republic, this too was an act of appeasement. This was an ambiguous pardon, even if Dreyfus fought, and ultimately successfully, to rehabilitate his name. For Clemenceau, Dreyfus in signing the withdrawal of his appeal in order to be pardoned, had killed the affair. Because for him, the trial was essentially a campaign in a larger war, and Dreyfus's personal fate was wholly secondary. Indeed, Clemenceau could be cruel. At the end of his life, he said about Alfred Dreyfus, "He was the only one who never understood anything about his own affair." What was Clemenceau's attitude to the Jews? Very briefly, his view of anti-Semitism was rooted in the Enlightenment, in a critique of Orthodox Catholicism. He, born a Catholic from the west of France, was as anti-Christian as Voltaire and shared much of Voltaire's hostility to the church, and to a lesser extent believed that Judaism itself had helped to fabricate the yoke of the church. We can find in his outlook a curious blend of anti-Jewish stereotypes and philo-Semitism. He distrusted Jewish financiers, and particularly self-hating Jews like the royalist Arthur Meyer, whom he regarded as an archetype of the inauthentic Jew. Of Joseph Reinach, a Dreyfusard and the great historian of the affair, who wrote 7 volumes of L'Histoire de l'Affaire Dreyfus, of Joseph Reinach he noted that he had the peculiarity among Jews of not being an anti-Semite. Clemenceau made disparaging remarks about Jews in the publishing world. If you read a collection of sketches and stories which he wrote about East European Jews after a visit to Galicia in 1898, it's full of images of leprous Jews, greasy Jews, wiping their noses in their clothes, dunking their beards or fingers in their soup. Clemenceau really didn't like what he saw in Galicia when he came to Krakow, the synagogue. He was touched by nausea. His descriptions go on to the verge of anti-Semitism, and yet he recognized a great deal of energy and willpower in the East European Jews. He was fascinated by Jewish hustle and bustle. He was friendly with many Jews, and indeed some of them were in his inner circle, including people who were to play an important role in the 1920s and 30s, like Georges Mandel, Georges Wormser, and Louis Klotz. And, curiously enough, his brother, his son, and 2 of his grandchildren married Jewish women. Perhaps that explains why the anti-Semite and Catholic Xavier Vallat, who was a commissioner for Jewish affairs under the Vichy regime, called him the most dangerous politician in the Third Republic. If Clemenceau was ambivalent about Jews, this was certainly not the case of the second man I would like to discuss briefly, Bernard Lazare, the first Dreyfusard, in many respects the forgotten prophet of the affair, who carried the torch in the loneliest phase before public opinion was mobilized in France. Bernard Lazare represents well, I think, the dimension of the affair, because he insisted that Dreyfus had been condemned as a Jew and that he was fighting his cause above all else on this basis. This may not sound surprising to you at first sight, but 100 years ago, this was a somewhat shocking assertion in Republic France. It was embarrassing to the Dreyfus family, to the majority of French Jews, and indeed to many Dreyfusards. Lazare was convinced that the arrest and conviction of Dreyfus and the hysterical reaction that it provoked in the first 2 months before he came to trial was reminiscent of medieval persecutions and of the kind of atmosphere he had read about that surrounded ritual murder cases. Lazare was a great authority on anti-Semitism. 4 years earlier, he had written one of the pioneering studies, a history of anti-Semitism, its origins and its causes, published in 1894 in France, which I had the honor of writing an introduction to recently when a new edition, English translation, appeared. He was a militant anarchist, and he knew well the power of the press to whip up hysteria and fear. He observed that the new anti-Semitic mass circulation paper of Edouard Drumont, La Libre Parole, the free word, had claimed immediately on Dreyfus's address, arrest, that the affair would be hushed up precisely because Dreyfus was a Jew. And Lazare predicted correctly that anyone who defended Dreyfus could henceforth be sure that he would be branded as a paid-up member of a so-called Jewish syndicate. This myth of a Jewish syndicate was one of the most powerful anti-Semitic fantasies of the affair, and has a very important, I think, role in the subsequent history of anti-Semitism in the 20th century. And Lazare already saw it coming. The myth of the Jewish syndicate and the way that it poisoned public opinion in France against any revision of the case. He noted that such was the state of French opinion that a Jewish traitor was literally needed to replace the classic image of Judas, to reinforce a long anti-Semitic campaign of which the Dreyfus affair was only the final act. In 1896, Bernard Lazare published the first reasoned, logical, documented defense of Dreyfus, an argument for the revision of his trial, called Une erreur judiciaire, la vérité sur l'affaire Dreyfus, a judicial error, the truth about the Dreyfus affair. He traveled widely, collected evidence, masterminded a poster and propaganda campaign to try and get public opinion awakened. But at the request of Alfred Dreyfus's brother, Mathieu, he withdrew from the front line after January, February 1898 to let others, beginning with Émile Zola, take the central role. Yet a year and a half later, he wrote in an open letter to the president of the new organization called the Rights League of the Rights of Man, protesting the silencing of the Jewish aspect of the affair and his own role. "I want it to be said," he said, "that the first who spoke, the first who stood up for a martyred Jew, was a Jew who knew to what an outcast, disinherited, ill-starred people he belonged, and drew from this consciousness the will to fight for justice and truth." This was a little bit too Jewish for the Dreyfusar strategists or for the Dreyfus family, and indeed for many French Jews at the time. After reading Dreyfus's account of his experiences as a prisoner on Devil's Island, which was published in 1901 already in France, Cinq années de ma vie, 5 years of my life, Bernard Lazare wrote to him, "You're perhaps more Jewish than you think. Through your incoercible hope, your almost fatalistic resignation. It is this indestructible foundation which has come to you through your people. It is what has sustained you." Interestingly enough, Alfred Dreyfus would have none of this. As far as he was concerned, what had sustained him was not his belief in Judaism, but rather his almost religious fixation on his patrie, on the fatherland, on France, and on its army, which had put him where he was, in exile. There was a yawning gulf between his perception and that of Lazare, as there was between their respective ideas about the state and the army. Yet relations between them remained cordial, as they did between Lazare and that other leading Jewish Dreyfusar, Joseph Reinach. Lazare wrote to Reinach in 1896, despite the great difference in their political ideas. We are each of us being attacked as Jews. This is why we can forget our economic and philosophical differences and agree on the fight to be waged against anti-Semitism. Lazar was shocked that so few French Jews rallied to Dreyfus's cause. And indeed he wrote bitterly that thousands would have been found to mount watch around Devil's Island, along with the most devoted champions of the fatherland. This led him to a far-reaching critique of the politics of assimilation. He said it had denationalized the Jews. It had brought them to a state of psychological servitude. If they had acquiesced passively in the campaign against Dreyfus, this was a sign they must have become demoralized. They wanted at all costs to preserve their status and privileges. This to him was decadence, a lack of solidarity which made them incapable of self-defense against anti-Semitism. Therefore, the answer to this psychology was a conscious effort to re-Judaize the Jew, to teach him to live for and be himself, to accept his pariahood and to draw strength from that. There would be no individual freedom for the Jews without group autonomy. Assimilation, he said, had been a disaster. This from a man who had been deeply and profoundly assimilationist himself only a few years earlier. It was a spurious doctrine. It undermined the foundations of Jewish existence by destroying collective group identity and purpose. The Jews constituted in his eyes an oppressed worldwide proletarian nation which had a legitimate case for national self-determination, which was perfectly compatible with the concept of individual freedom. True, he was a special kind of Zionist. He was one who shared some of Herzl's analysis of the Jewish question, but disagreed with his political methods and regarded him as essentially bourgeois in his social concepts. But Bernard Lazare, 100 years ago, had broken already with the dominant French credo of the Republic, one and indivisible, la République une et indivisible. In that sense, he was 100 years ahead of his time, because today, in that same Republic, that whole politics of assimilation, whatever the ethnic minorities and whatever the groups that are under discussion, is no longer held as the dogma that it once used to be. Le droit à la différence, the right to difference, the right to be different, is now accepted in a way that it never was 100 years ago. One of the most important differences between our time and then. Lazare had been the one to go to Émile Zola in November 1897 and to plead with him to intervene in the case of Dreyfus. He admired Zola not so much as an artist, but as a socially and politically committed writer. He had read Émile Zola's impassioned article in May 1896, A Plea for the Jews, Pour les Juifs, in which he had protested against the anti-Semitism which had been unleashed in France, calling it a moral gangrene which was destroying French society. Zola, a non-Jew of Italian origin, saw in this agitation the visible threat of a return to the Dark Ages, to the religious wars of the 16th and 17th centuries, the Inquisition, and so on. He was deeply shocked by the imbecilic lie of anti-Semitism, which had sown such hysteria and which he saw as behind the judicial error that had been committed in the Dreyfus case. And in a series of articles beginning in November 1897, he began to develop his own campaign, first against the notion of a Jewish conspiracy, the Jewish syndicate to which I referred earlier, And then, in an appeal to the youth of France, the Lettre à la Jeunesse, in which he argued passionately against the corruption of a younger generation, asking himself what kind of a prospect was there for the 20th century, the dawning 20th century, when the youth of France could be so susceptible to the lies of anti-Semitism at that time. He warned against the danger of military dictatorship, what he called the Boulangist temptation in France, the secret desire for a strong man, for a military dictator. Something was rotten in the state of France. There was a plot at work which threatened its moral health and future. This was the background to the writing of J'accuse. It followed in the wake of the acquittal of Count Esterhazy, the man who was the real spy and traitor, who had been acquitted thanks to the protection of the French General Staff. Zola was outraged and then wrote his open letter in which he spoke of a judicial crime and the crime of exploiting patriotism for works of hatred and the crime of transforming the sword into a modern god. He attacked the army, the government, the parliament, public opinion in an unprecedented assault on authority, going well beyond his earlier articles in which he had still retained a more respectful civil style. This was a declaration of war at great personal risk, which completely transformed the case of Alfred Dreyfus into a public affair that divided the country down the line. Attacking sacred French institutions, and there was no more sacred institution than the army at that time. And this, in turn, led many other writers and artists to join the struggle. For instance, Anatole France, who at that time was probably the best known and distinguished writer in France, along with Zola, who had never admired him as a writer, but now recognized his intervention as a great revolutionary act, as a defense of the liberal France of the rights of man, which was now under threat. Zola found himself subjected to an unprecedented campaign of slander, the target of nationalist and anti-Semitic hatred. He was vilified as a sexual deviant. In the caricatures of the time, you always see him either standing in lavatories or eating out of them. He's portrayed as a rootless Venetian, because his father was Italian, a lackey of the Jews, a treacherous foreigner, a slanderer of the army, although he was born in France and was the glory of French literature at that time. Maurice Barrès, another famous French writer of the period who knew him well, could write in 1898, "What is Monsieur Émile Zola? I look at him in his roots. This man is not a Frenchman." And thus he became as much an object of slander as Dreyfus himself, no less a Judas figure for the anti-Dreyfusar. It's interesting that Zola retained a close relation with Dreyfus after the prisoner had returned to France in June 1899. And I mention this point because numerous Dreyfusars became disillusioned with Alfred Dreyfus, including Clemenceau and Colonel Picard and his advocate Laborie, because he did not sufficiently correspond to their idea of an impassioned victim who spoke in the way that they expected. Zola did not share this view. And it's very interesting to see the religious imagery that he used, he, the anti-clerical Zola. For instance, in a letter to Alfred Dreyfus's wife, published in Lahore on the 29th of September 1899. He calls Dreyfus the martyr, the crucified one, le crucifié, the one who has been resurrected from the grave, who has come out alive from the tomb. A miracle had helped to remove the heavy stone which guarded his tomb. And now the tortured victim, le supplicié, has come down from the cross. Zola stated that French society could never pay its debt enough to this Jewish martyr, who had been purified by his suffering, sanctified by pain, and would now enter into the temple of the future. This Christ-like figure, spat upon by the mob, cruelly abused, his innocence would become an unforgettable example to the world. He would be venerated. This homme élu, this man elected by suffering, in whom the universal communion would be consummated. This quasi-religious imagery transfigured Alfred Dreyfus into the just man, le juste. Crucified twice, in his first trial of 1895 and the second trial of 1899. Moreover, by those Christian believers who worshipped and prayed to the Christ of Golgotha. Dreyfus, therefore, is transfigured by this secular, militant, anti-clerical into a painful, tragic image of Jesus himself. Only this time, resurrected as a hero for a new religion that will replace Christianity, a religion of truth and justice. He wrote to Madame Dreyfus that the innocent Dreyfus has found a worldwide echo. He wrote, "I look through the course of history for a similar movement of universal fraternity, and I do not find it." This was to be the universal value of the new brotherhood of man. Dreyfus as the symbol and Émile Zola as the prophet. Of course, in Catholic France, the majority of Catholics did not share this view. Thus far, I have only discussed the Dreyfusard outlook. We need to look also at what was the point of view, what was the value system of the anti-Dreyfusard. What did they think of these assertions? What was their motivation? The basic argument of the anti-Dreyfusard was a seemingly pragmatic and plausible claim that we have heard in other contexts. What sense did it make to sacrifice the interests of a nation, its national security, the trust of the people in its army, for the rights of one man, however deserving or legitimate? France had been humiliated in 1870 as a result of the Franco-Prussian War. It had lost Alsace and Lorraine. There could be no mercy for a traitor who had delivered military secrets to the hereditary enemy, the historic enemy, Germany. How could one question the verdict of seven officers and gentlemen? And if one did question them, would this not weaken the prestige of the French army, which was the bulwark of the nation, which was its hope for the revenge? The honor of the army was the most powerful rallying cry of the anti-Dreyfusard forces. And it was one that was widely shared by a majority of the press and of ordinary citizens. The anti-Dreyfusards had a different conception of order, of authority, of discipline. They argued that the rights of the collectivity must take precedence over the rights of the individual, that reasons of state were more weighty than doctrines like the rights of man. Some even said that even were Dreyfus innocent, no revision of his case should be allowed to endanger French national interests. The founder of the ultranationalist L'Action Française, Charles Maurras, even argued that the forging of documents in the Dreyfus case was permissible in the name of patriotic duty. In other words, the anti-Dreyfus are appealed to the sentiment of my country, right or wrong. Faith was more important than reason. Instinct was more valuable than critical faculties. Roots in the soil counted for more than universal truths. In any case, as a French writer Maurice Barrès insisted, morality and justice were not universal truths, but relative values. There were many prominent members of the French Academy, novelists like Paul Bourget and Jules Verne, the poet Paul Valéry, the painters Renoir and Degas, who were anti-Dreyfusards. So were some of the outstanding caricaturists of the time, like Caron, Dash, and Jean Forain. If the students of the humanities at the Sorbonne and at the École Normale Supérieure were by and large Dreyfusards, then there were many students of medicine and law who were anti. In 1898, when the League of the Rights of Man was founded in France to seek the revision of the case, another league was founded, anti-Dreyfusard League, called the League of Patriots, which easily outnumbered the League of the Rights of Man. In other words, popular opinion was by no means Dreyfusard. And yet, Zola was to be vindicated when he insisted that truth is on the march and nothing can stop it. As we said before, Dreyfus was pardoned at the end of 1899. By 1906, the Dreyfusards came to power. Clemenceau was prime minister, and Lieutenant Colonel Picard, who had risked his career in the army in the name of a revision of the case, became Minister of War. The wheel had turned full circle, and the anti-Dreyfusards appeared to have been routed. Yet appearances can be deceptive, and the triumph of liberal democracy in France was by no means assured. The Dreyfus case gave birth to the radical right in France. It helped to create the intellectual seeds of fascism in 20th century Europe. And there is no doubt that anti-Semitism provided the mold in which the affair was formed and greatly envenomed the debate. There was another important consequence. At the public degradation of Alfred Dreyfus at the École Militaire in Paris on the 5th of January 1895, there was a Viennese Jewish journalist, Theodor Herzl, who reported to his newspaper on these events. 4.5 years later, Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, modern political Zionism, described what he believed to have been at stake in this case. And his conclusion related to the condition of the Jew in modern society. Herzl wrote, "The Jew who tries to adapt himself to his environment, to speak its language, to think its thoughts, to sew its insignia on his sleeves, only to have them ruthlessly ripped away, Dreyfus represents that bastion that has been and still is a point of struggle. But unless we are deceived, that bastion is lost." This was a very pessimistic view, but one which 40 years later was to receive a macabre consummation in the Holocaust. Herzl argued already in 1900 that if liberal Republican France, the cradle of the rights of man, the first European country to emancipate the Jews, could be so infected with anti-Semitic chauvinism, what could European Jewry expect from less civilized nations? There could therefore only be one solution, which was a free an independent Jewish state in Palestine, which would deliver the equal citizenship for Jews and freedom that they had been promised by the French Revolution, but which had yet to be fully delivered. In his diaries in 1895 in Paris, Herzl makes an observation that he learnt a great deal during his stay there from the writings of the leading anti-Semite in France at that time, Edouard Drumont. And it is very interesting to look at an article that Drumont wrote immediately after the arrest of Dreyfus in his own newspaper, La Libre Parole. This piece was entitled The Soul of Dreyfus, L'âme de Dreyfus. And it was almost certainly read by Herzl. Typically, Drumont attacked the Jews as cosmopolitan nomads who did not belong in any country. They were alien to the legends and the habits, the myths, the traditions of ancient France, la vieille France. Treason was in their blood, for they had no concept of country, of loyalty or honor. Drumont insisted that Jews must be denied full citizenship, and above all, public office. If they resisted this proposal, he concluded, they would be preparing, and I quote, the most frightening catastrophe of their tragic history. This in 1894. Drumont's anti-Semitism found a powerful echo in the popular press, in clerical circles, among royalists and nationalists. By then, modern anti-Semitism had emerged in France as an integrative myth, something that could unite under certain circumstances, Catholics and secular Republicans, aristocrats and plebeians, conservatives and radicals, an ideology that could transcend class divisions. The legend of the Jew as Judas, of the Jews as a race of Iscariot, a race of traitors, was given a new life. As Daniel Halevi wrote, Dreyfus was Judas. His infamy was taken as a symbol. This insult to his person insulted a whole race. The nationalist writer Barrès was even more explicit. That Dreyfus is a traitor, I conclude, from his race. At the beginning of 1898, this kind of rhetoric exploded in the main cities of France and led to shouts of death to the Jews, from Paris to Marseille, from Lyon to the eastern frontier. In French Algeria, this took an openly pogrom-like form with violent attacks on Jews. A young Italian immigrant, 26-year-old Maximilian Regis, only just naturalized, was elected mayor of Algiers by the French settlers on an anti-Semitic program. He came to Paris and called on the cheering rabble to water the tree of freedom with the blood of the Jews. His followers sang vitriolic anti-Semitic lyrics to the sanguinary rhythms of the Marseillaise. They invented an anti-Jewish Marseillaise. Only at the end of 1899 would the French government decisively crack down on this atmosphere of mob hysteria. And yet, the French Jews weathered the storm with their belief in assimilation and in the Republic intact. And no one illustrated their touching, perhaps naive, but sincere faith in France better than Dreyfus himself. To the end, the model of the loyal, patriotic officer, despite all the grotesque slanders that have been directed at him, to the contrary. If you read the heart-rending correspondence with his wife from Devil's Island, always his thoughts are concentrated on France, on his family, with his wife from Devil's Island. Always his thoughts are concentrated on France, on his family, on the good name of the Dreyfus family and the atrocious mental suffering that he had undergone. He was convinced of the generosity, the impartiality of the Republic, of the army chiefs, The very people who had put him where he was, who had spat him forth, the ignominy of exile. In his own mind, Alfred Dreyfus saw himself only as the victim of a tragic error, not the flag bearer of a cause. He showed great strength of character and stoicism, but it was not inspired either by his Jewishness or by Dreyfusar ideals of justice, liberty, and republican virtue. For the Dreyfusars, he was an abstraction, a symbol, perhaps a political instrument. But he desired neither to be a hero or a scapegoat, even at the risk of disappointing those who had saved him. It is extraordinary to think that his almost religious faith in France was never shaken by the tortures inflicted on him by his country. France and truth remained synonymous to Dreyfus, as patriotism and justice. This simple-minded trust in France and family honor gave him the strength to bear his terrible ordeal. In 1935, the year in which he died, he told Victor Bache, an old Dreyfusar and the president of the Rights of Man, "I was only an artillery officer whom a tragic error prevented from pursuing his career. Dreyfus, as a symbol of justice, is not me. That Dreyfus was created by you." 5 years later, the France of Pétain began to collaborate with Hitler's new order. And in many respects, Vichy would be the culmination of the anti-Dreyfusar tradition that had developed 50 years earlier. The Vichy which passed the racial laws, the Statut des Juifs of 1940, which unequivocally revoked Jewish emancipation in France. Alfred Dreyfus's granddaughter, Madeleine Lévy, who was a martyr of the underground resistance in France, was rounded up and sent to Auschwitz, where she died in January 1944. Many other members of the family fought in the French resistance. The line which led from Fin de siècle Paris to restore Jerusalem also led tragically enough to Auschwitz. One of the architects of the French collaboration with the Nazis was Charles Maurras, who all his life was obsessed by the Dreyfus case. He was a French nationalist, a hater of Germany, a real Germanophobe, and yet he collaborated with the Nazis in 1940. By a strange irony of history, on the 27th of January 1945, Charles Maurras, the leader of the ultra-right movement L'Action Française, was sentenced by a French court in Lyon to national degradation, the same charge that had been made against Dreyfus 50 years earlier, almost to the day. Sentenced to national degradation for intelligence with the enemy. As he was led away, he shouted, "C'est la revanche de Dreyfus." It is the revenge of Dreyfus. And today, 100 years later, give or take a few, Dreyfus still lives on as a powerful symbol of injustice and its reparation, of human rights and of nationalist passions and the evils of prejudice. Thank you.
You have been listening to historian Robert Wistrich of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Our thanks to Professor Wistrich and to Professor Mark Rader and the Department of Judaic Studies for their assistance. This edition of Talking History was produced by the University at Albany Department of History Production Center. Recorded and edited by Susan McCormick.
You have been listening to another edition of Talking History. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. For more information about Talking History, write Talking History, Department of History, University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12222.